You'll hear arguments next in Swisher against Brady. Mr. Nelson, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm here seeking reversal of the opinion of the three-judge federal court below, which held that Maryland's juvenile justice system of delinquency hearings before masters, with review available from the juvenile court judge by way of exception, offends the constitutional bar against double jeopardy. Under Maryland's present statutes and rules governing juvenile court proceedings, most of the more populous local jurisdictions in Maryland, as well as some of the rural counties, employ masters for the purpose of conducting various hearings within the juvenile court system. The utilization of these masters, which also characterizes the juvenile justice systems of approximately 34 other states, is designed both to assist the circuit court system in dealing with the extremely heavy caseload in the juvenile area, and also to provide for the involvement in the process of persons who, by virtue of their interests, expertise, and permanent assignment to the juvenile court system, can bring to bear in the disposition of juvenile causes a familiarity with and sensitivity to the special needs and problems of juveniles charged with committing acts in violation of the state's criminal laws. Under Maryland's system, the juvenile court judge hears originally all petitions for waiver of jurisdiction to the criminal courts for trial as adults, and also generally hears originally the more aggravated charges such as murder, rape, or armed robbery, as well as cases where exceptions to a master's proposal are anticipated in advance of the proceedings. With certain other limited exceptions, other delinquency cases, including arraignment, detention, adjudication, and disposition, may be assigned for the hearing of evidence to one of the full-time masters employed by the court. Under both the statute and under Maryland Rule 911, when a master conducts an adjudicatory and a disposition hearing, he is required to transmit his proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations, and proposed disposition orders to the juvenile court judge within 10 days of the conclusion of the disposition hearing.
Well, there are two judges and seven masters in Baltimore County.
In Baltimore City, there is one judge and seven masters,
one
I believe.
And seven.
That's correct. In the other counties, the ratio more closely approximates 1-to-1. The figures, both as to judges and masters, I think, are given in our brief. Mm-hmm. Both the statute and the rule provide that these proposed findings, conclusions, and recommendations do not constitute orders or final action of the court, and that final adjudication and disposition orders are only entered by the juvenile court judge following his consideration of any exceptions which may be filed within 5 days, or if no exceptions are filed, following his concurrence in the master's recommendations if he agrees with them.
What would happen under Maryland law if the master simply by mistake failed to transmit his findings to the juvenile court judge? Could the state go out and incarcerate the juvenile on the basis of the master's finding?
He could not. There would be no order of the court on the basis of which the state could act. There would have been no disposition of that case if there had been no transmittal of the findings and no order entered. The only officer in the court system with the power to enter an order disposing of the case and providing for a disposition of that juvenile is the judge. Now, in terms of the submission of recommendations and findings, while, as I've just indicated, the rule and the statute do require that those recommendations and the findings of fact be transmitted to the judge, that is frequently waived by the parties, and this is pointed out on a number of occasions in the Appellee's brief. That occurs in situations where the parties essentially are acquiescing in the master's proposed disposition of the case, which he announces at the hearing, and they will say
but
to the master, they
order.
Will. Pardon me?
Still an order is entered, signed by the judge in those cases?
Still an order is entered, signed by the
signed
judge.
Signed by the judge.
That's correct. While understandably few recommendations are disturbed by the juvenile court judge in the absence of exceptions by either the state or the juvenile, the judge does have the authority, sua sponte, to either remand to the master for further hearing, to himself hold a further non-evidentiary hearing, or to himself hold a supplemental evidentiary hearing if both the state and the juvenile agree to the taking of additional evidence. This case focuses on the double jeopardy implications of the review of the master's recommendation upon the filing of exceptions thereto by the state. Appellees argue that regardless of the basis for the exceptions, and regardless of whether additional evidence is heard by the judge with the consent of all parties, including the juvenile, or whether the judge's review is solely on the record, the juvenile is placed in jeopardy at the evidentiary adjudicatory hearing before the master, that jeopardy concludes upon the filing of the master's recommendations, and that any consideration given by way of review of the juvenile court judge upon the filing of an exception by the state to a master's recommendation of non-delinquency finding constitutes a new and impermissible second jeopardy. Obviously, the state disagrees with all of the elements of that position taken by the appellees.
What consequence can flow from the master's action before the judge has acted on it?
In a situation where a master has adjudicated that the child committed an act and is proposing detention of the child, for example, there may be certain consequences with respect to a temporary continuation of a detention that is already in place pending the disposition of the matter, but no final disposition whatsoever can flow from that recommendation.
Are they usually in custody or not, or can't you generalize about that?
I think that in the majority of cases they are not, but I'm not certain I could generalize on that.
Help me out on another thing. It's the same judge involved in the counties and in the city.
Be different judges involved.
No. I mean, in the Baltimore City, you've got one.
That's correct. There is a specially assigned juvenile judge.
So after the master's report, it goes back to the same judge. Am I right?
All master's reports go to a single judge. That's correct.
In this case, we're talking about is one judge.
That is correct. I think Judge Hammerman was the juvenile judge in Baltimore City for some 8 years, and then Judge Karwacki, and there's evidence from both of those two judges in the record. The appellee's initial attack on the Maryland system culminated in the decision of the Maryland Court of Appeals in Matter of Anderson in 1974, and because there are several prior proceedings in this case that are relevant, I thought it best to just describe them briefly to the court. In that case, certain juveniles challenged the provisions of what was then Maryland Rule 908 and is now 911, which authorized the state to file exceptions to a master's recommendation of non-delinquency, contending there that the provision for a de novo hearing before the juvenile court judge violated applicable double jeopardy principles. At that time, the rules did permit a de novo hearing upon exception by the state. Assuming, in correct anticipation of this court's subsequent decision in Breed versus Jones, that double jeopardy principles applied to adjudications of delinquency in juvenile court, Maryland's Court of Appeals rejected the challenge to the rule permitting exceptions by the state on the grounds that the juvenile master is a ministerial and not a judicial officer, that under the Maryland Constitution he is entrusted with no part of the judicial power of the state, that his recommendations are only that and do not become binding unless and until approved by the judge, and that accordingly the hearing before the master is not such a hearing that places a juvenile in jeopardy at the time that hearing occurs. Following that decision, review of which was denied by this court for want of a substantial federal question, the appellees filed this case and companion habeas corpus petitions in the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland. The habeas cases were heard and decided first, resulting in an opinion in June of 1975 in Aldridge versus Dean, concluding that the ability of the state to file exceptions to the master's finding and to obtain a de novo adjudicatory hearing before a judge, again under the former version of the Maryland rule, violated the rights of juveniles not to be twice placed in jeopardy for the same offense. Immediately following the decision in the habeas cases, the Maryland Court of Appeals adopted amended juvenile court rules, which explicitly confirmed the holding in Matter of Anderson that the master's recommendations are proposed only and are not binding or final orders of the court. The new rules also denied to the state, when it takes exception to the master's recommendation, the opportunity to adduce any new evidence before the juvenile court judge without the consent of the juvenile. Moreover, the juvenile court statute effective July 1, 75, required for the first time that proceedings before the masters be recorded, thus making possible meaningful review by the juvenile court judge on the record developed before the master. Appellees then filed a supplemental complaint, in this case, alleging a violation of double jeopardy, notwithstanding the changes in the rules. Additional evidence was introduced, and the opinion below followed in September of 77.
Mr. Attorney General, one point along the other one I asked. If the judge tries the case without the master and says, I find no evidence of guilt, and I quit, and I release, or whatever the ruling is, there's nothing the state can do.
Well, there's nothing further within the state court system. That's correct.
There's nothing in the state court.
There's not. I don't believe there's no appeal.
But if the master, I think that's the point the other side is making. I want to get to you. If the master recommends that he be released, then the state can file exceptions.
The state can file exceptions with the juvenile court judge. That's correct.
And the reason that your answer to, excuse me, my brother Marshall's first question, there's nothing the state can do if the judge finds no delinquency or whatever that it is, you said is a matter of state law. Well, it's a matter of constitutional double jeopardy law, isn't it?
That's correct,
the juvenile could not be subjected to jeopardy before that judge for the same offense again.
That's right. You could not. That's the state fine. Could not then take that juvenile, for example, and do what was done in Breed versus Jones, which is to attempt to try him in the adult court.
Or anywhere.
I think they could go up and attempt to seek a reversal and bring it back down for retrial or reconsideration back in the juvenile court system. But what we've got here is confined entirely within the juvenile court system at the lower court level, and we would submit essentially is one continuous proceeding. Now, there are two parts to the state's argument on the double jeopardy point. The first is that essentially jeopardy does not attach at the hearing before the master, and the basis for that is that he is not the trier of fact with authority to enter a judgment of conviction or acquittal or the equivalent thereof.
At what point do you fix its attachment?
Jeopardy would attach at the moment that case file, that the record in that case, that the evidence, that the recommendations of the master are given to the juvenile court judge.
Even before he signs an order?
That is correct. Once that is before the judge, then essentially evidence is before the trier of fact, that officer who has authority to enter an order of guilt or innocence or delinquency or non-delinquency in a case.
But then, General Nilsen, is it your view that the state could complete its presentation of evidence before the master and lose, and then instead of filing exceptions, you could say, I think we'll start over and get some more evidence?
Before the when you say lose, you mean the master?
The master make a recommendation of no finding of delinquency. And then instead of taking exceptions, I take it your view is the state could say, well, let's go back and get some more witnesses and have another hearing.
Well, that is, I suppose, theoretically possible under the part of our argument that says that jeopardy does not attach until it gets to the judge. That's correct. And I think the only way to respond to that in terms of suggesting that might not be permissible is that there you would have the state interrupting a continuous process which is established. And that continuous process moves from the master to the judge. The state, on its own initiative and working against that continuous process, would be interrupting it and taking it back and starting over again. And I can see, even under the first theory, that argument being made to the effect that that would constitute subjecting him to double jeopardy. Under the state's second theory of the case,
I understand.
Then I think clearly that would constitute double jeopardy because he would no longer be within the continuous process. He would have interrupted the continuous process. And the second part of our argument essentially begins with an assumption that contrary to the Maryland Court of Appeals, this court holds that jeopardy begins to attach at the hearing before the master. And then the state's position is that it is a single jeopardy as long as you stay within that continuous process on through the stage of the case where the judge enters the order. But that if you interrupt that continuum, then you would be violating double jeopardy under the state's second argument.
I have a little trouble. Maybe a procedure will help me. When the juvenile is brought in before the juvenile judge, why is he in jeopardy then?
At what stage, Mr. Justice Marshall?
The beginning.
Well, he wouldn't.
Because, as I understand, you said the judge can try him then and there, right?
Well, typically he would not be brought before. If he was brought before the judge for an adjudicatory hearing directly, yes. But typically that does not happen. Typically the juvenile does not come into contact with the judge at a hearing until the final stage, except in the cases that I mentioned earlier, which is a waiver hearing where the issue is whether jurisdiction should be waived to the criminal court, whether it's an aggravated offense, or it's a situation where they anticipate in advance that exceptions would be taken to a finding of the master. But
he is just told to appear before the magistrate.
That is correct. Generally speaking, he never appears before the judge.
Does the magistrate ask him if he's guilty?
Pardon me?
Is it the magistrate who asks him, did you do that?
Well, it is the master who presides over the taking of evidence.
That
would involve testimony put on by the state's attorney and testimony put on by the juvenile, which might include testimony by the juvenile. Thirdly, and this is, I think, the third argument of the state really relates to the first two, is that even if a system such as that embodied in Maryland's juvenile court statutes and rules would be viewed as violative of double jeopardy if applied to trials in the criminal courts, special consideration of the need for some informality, flexibility, and experimentation in the juvenile justice setting should lead to a conclusion that the entertainment by a judge of exceptions filed by the state, as we have here, does not violate principles of fundamental fairness and is not contrary to double jeopardy prescriptions in the context, the special context of juvenile court proceedings.
In Maryland, did you ever have was there any period when, rather than having masters take this first step and make the preliminary inquiry, this was done by interviews at the hands of trained social and behavioral professionals who were not lawyers?
That is still done to a considerable extent. There is a very elaborate, what we call an intake process.
Was there a time when it went directly from, without the intervention of a master, from this professional, non-lawyer, however, to the juvenile judge with a report?
I suspect that there was a time when that happened. Masters haven't been employed forever in Maryland. I think they date back to the middle 40s.
This is certainly common in many states even today, is it not, if you know?
The employment of intake officers in these it is common in many states, and as I said, it is used frequently in Maryland, and there are many cases that are disposed of by these intake officers who are not lawyers, not masters, not judges, before the case ever gets up to even the master stage or the judge stage. So that a very large percentage of today's high volume of juvenile matters are disposed of through that intake process, and thus never get before, for any kind of an adjudicatory hearing, before a master or a judge. The state's first argument as on the question of when jeopardy attaches is both set forth in the first part of our brief and is reflected, as I indicated before, in the Maryland Court of Appeals decision in matter of Anderson, and represents the approach adopted by several other state courts which have considered this issue. Rather than attempt to fully restate that portion of our argument, I would like to simply focus on the implications of this court's decision in Breed versus Jones relative to that particular argument and this particular case. The holding in Breed was, of course, limited to the proposition that once a juvenile court finds that a juvenile has committed acts that violate a criminal law, the juvenile has been put in jeopardy and cannot thereafter be waived to the adult criminal court system for trial because such a criminal trial would constitute a second and impermissible jeopardy. In its opinion in Breed, this court made no distinction between the respective roles of a juvenile court referee and juvenile court judge in the California proceedings there at issue, but referred throughout to the actions of the juvenile court. Under the California system, dispositions proposed by referees do not require the affirmative concurrence of the juvenile court judge, but become final upon the failure of the judge to disturb them within 20 days following the hearing before the referee. This court did not consider or discuss in Breed the relative roles of the referee and the judge, since there was no need for it to do so. Appellees have correctly pointed out in their brief that an examination of the record in Breed indicates that the adjudicatory hearing, which occurred in that case, was in fact held before a referee rather than a judge. And from this, they have argued that the clear implication, if not the express holding of Breed, is that jeopardy attached in that case at the moment evidence was first presented to the California Juvenile Court referee. While this court could so conclude if and when expressly presented with a question, we submit that the question was not presented or decided in Breed. In essence, it is our position that the question of when jeopardy attaches in a juvenile court proceeding should be answered, as I indicated earlier, by holding that it attaches when evidence is first presented to that officer of the court who has the authority to decide factual questions and to dispose of the case by a finding of delinquency or non-delinquency. Whatever the precise point in time at which jeopardy attaches in the California system might be, we submit that the point in time at which jeopardy attaches in Maryland is when the recommendations of the master are presented to and considered by the juvenile court judge. The fact that the master has previously presided at an evidentiary hearing and formulated his own proposed findings should not have to be held to have accelerated the point in time at which jeopardy attaches. Surely the mere fact that evidence is presented before the master should not result in a holding that jeopardy attaches when that occurs. What is critical is the presentation of evidence to the trier of fact. The second part of the argument, as I indicated before, is premised on an assumption that the court should hold that jeopardy did begin to attach at that first hearing. And it is our position that the limited review by the juvenile court judge of the master's recommendation upon the filing of an exception at that point does not constitute a second and impermissible jeopardy. When that exception has been filed, there has been, at that point in time, no adjudication of acquittal or its equivalent, such as would constitute a termination of the initial jeopardy. Regardless of the subjective perception and sense of relief that the juvenile, upon hearing the master's proposed or recommended disposition of the case in his favor may have, the fact of the matter is that the master's recommendation is nothing more than advisory to the court and is not final unless and until approved by the juvenile court judge. The correctness of that assertion is not altered in the least by the fact that master's recommendations are generally adopted by the judge in the absence of exceptions by the parties. Appellees in their brief have made a great deal out of the fact that that the judges approve the vast majority of master's recommendations that are presented before them and move from that to argue that the judges are a mere rubber stamp. In the first place, I think it's terribly important for this court to understand several things about the facts that the appellees have brought to bear in dealing with that. Number one, they are talking about situations where no exceptions are filed to the master's recommendations. Therefore, it is natural that the judge would be inclined to accept and approve most of those recommendations. Also, in the bulk of those cases, both parties have even waived the requirement that the master prepare written findings, detailed written findings, to submit to the judge. I think it also must be borne in mind that those figures and the information in the record with respect to the amount of time spent by the juvenile court judge in reviewing master's recommendations predate the current rules. The testimony of Judge Karwacki, which is included in the appendix filed in this case, indicates that the judges do a conscientious job of reviewing those cases that are presented to the judges with written recommendations from the masters, and do on occasion listen to the recordings which are now made of the testimony and the proceedings before the master. Maryland rules provide that prior to the time that the judge enters an order, either the state or the juvenile may note an exception to the master's recommendation and have the matter considered by the judge before a final disposition of the case. When the juvenile notes an exception, the rule provides that he may elect either a hearing de novo or a hearing before the judge on the record established before the master. When the state notes an exception, the controlling rule now assures to the juvenile his right to insist, if he wishes, that the judge consider the case solely on the basis of the record which was made before the master and which caused the master to recommend in his favor. Alternatively, additional evidence may be presented to the judge, but only if he considers it relevant and if both the state and the juvenile consent to its introduction. Thus, the juvenile is able to prevent the state from presenting evidence which it did not present before the master or from retrying its case again before the judge. This is not a situation where there are separate proceedings before different tribunals, each of which can result in an adjudication for or against the juvenile. There is only one proceeding before the juvenile court, which consists of the presentation of evidence before and the issue of recommendations to the court by the master, and the final determination of the matter on behalf of the juvenile court by the judge, either following his consideration of any exceptions filed or following his concurrence in the recommendation of the master in the absence of exceptions, if he chooses to concur. The state's contention that the proceedings in Maryland juvenile courts are continuous in nature and involve only a single jeopardy does not require this court to now adopt the type of continuing jeopardy theory articulated first by Mr. Justice Holmes in Kepner v. United States. The Holmesian continuing jeopardy view clearly involves situations where the criminal justice process is punctuated by adjudications of innocent or guilt and thereafter proceeds to a contrary determination or a subsequent trial with the potential for producing another adjudication. Here the process is not so punctuated, because the Maryland rules provide that the first and only adjudication cannot and does not occur until after the completion of the entire process, when the juvenile court judge enters an appropriate order. When the judge entertains an exception filed by the state to the master's recommendation, he does so not in the context of a separate and distinct proceeding, but as the final stage in a single continuous proceeding.
But he can remand to the master, I take it.
The only situation under which a remand to the master is provided for is where the judge takes disagrees with the master's recommendation on his own initiative. Remand is not provided for in the situation where the matter goes to the judge on exception. That particular Maryland rule only provides for a hearing before the judge.
So the so when it gets to the judge on exceptions, the matter is up or voted up or down right there.
That is what the rule contemplates, and it's voted up or down on the basis of a non-evidentiary hearing when the state is the accepting party. Non-evidentiary hearing unless the juvenile and the state both consent to the introduction of additional evidence before the judge.
If the juvenile does the accepting, and the judge finds in his favor on his exception, the show is over, I think.
That's correct.
There's no sending back for a new trial.
There is no sending back for another trial before the master at that point. The state has used up what I would submit is the one card that it had available to it in the first place, and that is that single continuous proceeding. To hold that Breed versus Jones must be extended so as to bar the state from completing the process would represent, we submit, an unwarranted extension of double jeopardy principles within the juvenile justice system. And unless there are further questions at this point, I'd like to reserve the balance for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Let me state what I think is the heart of this case. A child is tried at a trial. I'm going to talk about that in a minute because it's a real trial. He's found not guilty. Witnesses testify, cross-examined, arguments, motions, legal points, exhibits, the whole bit, all pursuant to the procedural requirements that have been outlined by this Court in Galt and Winship and to some extent in Breed, although the first two obviously the most relevant. And at the end of it, the master considers his decision and he reviews the facts and the law and he says, Johnny, I find you're not guilty. And Johnny turns to his mother and smiles, and they go out of the courtroom, and everything's all finished.
Mr. Smith, you say the master says, I find you not guilty. I got the impression from the state's counsel that the master's really makes a recommendation to the juvenile judge.
Well, both of those statements that you made, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, can be reconciled, and perhaps it goes to the real heart of the case, because the theory of it is that a paper goes to the judge, which is a recommendation.
Well, but I want to be consistent with this procedure,
though, if the master didn't say, I find you not guilty, but said, Johnny, I'm going to recommend to the judge not to find you, to
yeah,
find
but
you
but
not
he doesn't
guilty.
Do that.
Well, so suppose he did. Would you be making a different argument?
No, I would not be making a different argument.
Well, then it's because it really isn't very relevant.
Well,
and
because
is the case going to turn on whether you have a loudmouthed, large-headed master?
No, not at all.
Well, you seem to suggest so. If he presumes to pronounce a judgment, you're saying that makes him a judge.
No.
And therefore, it creates jeopardy.
I do not think it turns on that at all. What I think it turns on is what, in fact, actually happens. Now, at the conclusion, the record, incidentally, supports, although I'm not saying that it is by any means critical to our ultimate position. Nonetheless, the record supports the characterization of what the master says that I just indicated.
Are you representing to the court that all seven magistrates at the conclusion of a hearing where they're going to recommend under the procedure no prosecution, no further proceedings, that they all make the announcement of you are not guilty?
Well, one of the masters, three masters testified in this, Mr. Chief Justice, one master who put in the record a stipulation of evidence indicated that he completely agreed with, he read the testimony of this first master and he said that he agreed with it and that in his experience as an assistant public defender before he was appointed to master, he observed this going on in every single master's courtroom. So I think the answer is the record does support that it happens in every courtroom.
Doesn't he say non-delinquent? There's no finding of guilt. They started that in the
Well, of course, technically, in the statute...
You don't find a man guilty or... You don't find a child guilty or not guilty.
Technically...
Find him delinquent or not delinquent.
Technically, in the statute, of course, it is delinquent or not delinquent. What I'm saying is, and the record clearly supports this, that the master explains it in the typical criminal lingo, because obviously a child is not going to understand the words delinquent or non-delinquent. Now, after the decision, after the... without trying to assume the conclusion, after the master makes this statement and the child and his parent leaves, the state's attorney decides that he wasn't satisfied with the result. He thought the child should have been found guilty. And so what does he do? He files an exception, and he then goes, takes that exception and files it with the clerk, and there is then another hearing before the judge. Now, it used to be that it was de novo. Now it's restricted under the amendment that was made. It was on the record, and we deal in our brief with the fact that we believe that distinction makes no difference under this Court's decision in the Jenkins case. And also, I might say, in the Kempner case of 1903. And so what happens? There's a new trial, a new fact finder. And this time, a new fact finder, whether it's with new evidence, which is what the statute provides, or the same evidence, or at least the tape recording of the evidence before the master, that judge then decides whether he believes the child is guilty or not guilty.
Mr. Smith, now, what if the foreman of a grand jury, after a grand jury had deliberated, saw the defendant standing outside the grand jury room and came out and said, "Congratulations, we've just found you not guilty." Do you think that the defendant could plead that in bar to an indictment rendered by another grand jury when he was brought to trial before a court of competent jurisdiction?
Absolutely not. And
well, then doesn't it really make some difference here whether the master's recommendation is something on which the state could base punishment of the child, or whether it's just a recommendation to a judge?
Well, but the state does base punishment of the child on it. That's the whole point. Now, this court has said...
Before the judge has signed any piece of paper?
Well, in response to the question you asked earlier, Mr. Chief Justice, the record indicates that all the time, children who are before a master, and the master finds them guilty and decides that holds a disposition hearing and says they ought to go to the training school, out the door they go to that training school that day. And 5 days later or thereafter, but at least 5 days later, when the judge signs that order, that child is very much in the training school. And I might say that if he's found not guilty, that child is very much at home. So in that sense, there's real substantial power that the master exercises.
Do you suggest that the detention of the child before the master's hearing is unconstitutional?
No. No.
Then why does it become somehow unconstitutional or illegal afterward in the interim between the master's recommendations and the judge's action?
I'm not suggesting that it is unconstitutional or illegal.
You did.
No. All I am saying is that in fact happens, because you asked a question to Mr. Nilsen earlier, getting at the point of what in fact happens to that child between the time that the master's hearing ends and when the recommendation goes to the judge. All I'm saying is that in that interim time, what happens is that in fact it's implemented. If the master found the child guilty and says he should go to a training school, off he goes. If the master says, "No, I find you not guilty," he goes home. Now, again, I don't suggest that decides the ultimate attachment of jeopardy, double jeopardy question, but certainly it gives a little background in terms of the reality of the situation.
Could a juvenile found to be delinquent by a master, and when the state agents come and say, "All right, now you're going off to the training school," he'd say, "Wait a minute, I've filed exceptions to the master's recommendation." Then would he still go to the training school?
Assuming the child finds an exception, files an exception.
Yes, yes. After a finding of delinquency.
If the child in that, well, he would have, first of all, he'd have to file it in that very courtroom that moment. Now, he could. I mean, his lawyer could hand the master a piece of paper and say.
And if he did that, would he still go off to the training school?
At that point, it would be up to the state to decide whether it wished to request detention between the time that piece of paper is filed and when the hearing is held before the judge. And if the state wishes to request detention, then the master can give it. And I might say...
Well, would he commence serving whatever confinement in whatever place the master had recommended as punishment or correction for his delinquency?
Well, he wouldn't commence serving in the sense of the beginning
he
of
might
a
be
post-conviction
detained.
Sentence.
He might be detained, just as a person can be detained after a prosecuting attorney files an information, but unless he can make bail.
That's true, although I don't know that it's a central difference, Justice Stewart, because
well,
in Maryland and in most
states...
Well,
it does have to do with whether or not this is a final judgment.
Well, in Maryland and... In Maryland, in most states, a child is, whether it's detained or committed, it's pursuant to an indeterminate commitment. At least it is in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to the same training school, and he may be in one cottage if it's detention and another cottage if it's commitment. Now, it seems to me that...
Well, can he say, look, I'm not ready to, you have no right to make me begin serving the recommended period of confinement. Because I've taken an exception to the finding of delinquency.
Well, he can't say that for two reasons. One, because
he can take an exception.
He can take an exception, but he can't say the first for two reasons. One, because there's no such thing as a recommended period of commitment because it's indeterminate.
Well, that's
why
the recommended period. You're committed to the training school until you're 18 years old.
The child can say, if Your Honor, please, when I go to the training school, I want everybody at the training school to know that I'm there in detention rather than commitment. And certainly the order will say detention rather than commitment. To that extent, the child can make that allegation. But the child cannot say, I'm sorry, I don't want to go anywhere because you have to wait till the judge does something.
Now,
to
take
me.
A child who has not been in detention but has been at home, and a considerable number are released to the custody of the parents. Is that not so, or to a foster home?
That is correct, both pre- and post-trial.
Now, the master makes his recommendations. Are you telling us that the child is immediately plucked out of his home and taken to a detention center, or can that only be done, as the Attorney General's office informed us, after the judge has signed something?
He's plucked out of his home and taken to the detention center, absolutely.
But it's not this case.
Well, as a matter of fact, I mean, there are nine plaintiffs in this case. I'm trying to think of whether, in each of these cases, of course, they were found not guilty, and there wasn't any request by the state to detain him pending, as far as I can recall. So it's true that that's not this case,
of
but
course,
what you just said
event,
would happen.
Your complaint, your grievance is not, in this case, is not with the situation where the person is found to be delinquent by the master, but rather when he's found to be non-delinquent
exactly.
by the master.
Now, If I could just get into the law a moment. The
Before
facts
you get to that, because I still am a little puzzled by your answer to Mr. Justice Stewart earlier. If there is a finding of delinquency, and if the child files exception, is there automatic taking him into custody, or does the state have to request custody?
If he's found delinquent, then...
And he makes promptly files exception.
All right. Now... Under the present procedure in Baltimore City, and it appears a slight doubt, but we believe that the rule is fairly clear, the statewide rule on this, an exception is not to be taken if a child is found, if the delinquent act is sustained. You see, there's a bifurcation between the delinquent act, which is the penal act, and the delinquent child, which is, does he need care, treatment, and supervision? And in Maryland, you're not allowed under court rule to take an exception until after the disposition hearing. Now, the disposition hearing may take place immediately after the trial.
Well, if the disposition hearing does not take place immediately, he won't be taken to a home right away.
All right. If the disposition hearing does not take place immediately after the trial, then an exception could not be filed.
Well, and he wouldn't go into a home.
Well, what then happens depends on what the state's and the master's desire is. The state may say, or the master may say, and they frequently do, that pending disposition hearing, I wish the child to be in detention. And if the master so finds, he is in detention. And the master enters an order. And I'd like to point
now,
this out.
Now, may the prosecutor say precisely the same thing at the beginning of the hearing?
At the beginning of the of the disposition or the trial?
At the beginning of the whole proceeding.
And when you say the same thing, I'm not...
Can the prosecutor, by the same procedure, cause the child to be detained during the hearing as well as immediately after it?
Well, yes, if you mean that the hearing goes on for more than a day or a morning, absolutely.
So that now, then really what is the greater? You were stressing the significance of the master's finding of delinquency. It doesn't seem to me that that is a significant, that is necessarily controlling in a case where exceptions are taken.
Well, my point is this. The significant fact, I believe, is that the master conducts what is conceded to be under Maryland law and what has been found to be by two federal district courts, I might say, a full trial. Then the child is found guilty or the master says you're guilty or not guilty, as the case may be. Now, the question is this. Two questions. Has he been in jeopardy during that period when he is before that master?
Well, could the master sentence him?
Well, again, we get involved in...
Could the master find him delinquent?
Again, we get involved in the terminology problem.
No. Could the master sign a piece of paper saying that this child is delinquent?
He does. He just doesn't sign the order.
No, he does not. As I understand, he recommends that the judge find him delinquent.
Well, the master, until 1975, two weeks after the...
Can the master commit him to training school until he's of age?
By signing an order? No. He may not sign the order.
No, that wasn't my question. Can he do it?
Yes.
How?
He does it by stating that he's going to do it and it's perfunctorily approved by the judge. Now, I know that one of the difficulties with this case, let me be very frank with you. I don't want to predict my own doom here. But there have been 15 judges have heard this case so far. 5 trial judges and 10 appellate judges. And all the appellate judges have ruled against us and all the trial judges have ruled in our favor, including the initial juvenile court trial judge. And I think I may have an idea as to why that's happened, because it takes a little bit of time to live with this case and realize the difference between whatever may have been the conceptions at one time or whatever may now be the conceptions of a master in chancery and a master in civil areas versus what is happening in this case.
Judge Winter is an appellate judge.
He sat as a trial judge, though, in this case. So I was referring to a judge in his capacity as trial judge at that moment. Now, when you look at all the facts in this case, you eventually, I believe, have to come to the conclusion that however you dress it up, it boils down to the fact that a child in a big urban court system such as Baltimore, with one judge and 7 masters, where the masters hear 90% of the cases, they're tried in front of masters for the most part, and they're full and complete trials. Now, there are only 2 questions that then have to be asked legally to determine whether or not that offends a double jeopardy clause.
Suppose you had 3 judges for each master in Baltimore. Would that change the constitutional situation?
Not if there was a full trial in front of the master. Not at all.
Full trial? Do you mean he must hear it de novo, not to do it on the record?
I said a full trial before the master. In other words, in my view, if there was a full trial before the master, that doesn't change the result that if it then goes before the judge later on, that it's not double jeopardy.
Suppose the record showed that the judge spent an average of 3 hours on each set of recommendations where there were exceptions.
Well, of course, if there are exceptions, Mr. Chief Justice, let's say there's an exception by the child. Normally, that's going to be a de novo hearing. It can be on the record, but normally the child will request a de novo hearing. Now, that takes it wholly outside of the framework of this case because it's like the United States v. Ball. The child didn't like what he got, and he sought a new trial. If it's the other way around, then, of course, we're right back into our case if the state takes an exception.
Now, does your case depend to any large extent on the perfunctory nature of the judge's review? Supposing, following up the Chief Justice's question, that each judge spent 3 hours on each juvenile case that the state appealed to him, just considering it, and at least as much time as the master had. Would your legal position be any different?
No. Now, the record shows that the judge spends an average of less than 1 minute on each order, and most of whatever is spent in review actually is in connection with disposition memos, because those are the only cases in which the court gets disposition memos. But my answer is no. Now, I think the facts of this case, in a way I can get strangled by the facts in this case, if one assumes that my answer to your question were the other way around. That is, that it really depends on how much time the master or the judge spends with the master's findings. We didn't put the facts in the case, I hope, so that I would get strangled with them. We put the facts in the case so that this court would have a good idea of what in fact goes on in the juvenile system in a big city and what in fact this role of the master is, so that this court would realize that the master simply is not some judge's employee anymore.
Would your case be different if 20% of the recommendations were not followed?
No, it would not.
90%?
It wouldn't make any difference in terms of whether the judge can retry him if it were 99%. Our legal conception would not be any different. I think that it certainly makes our case factually much more appealing that 99.99% are perfunctorily signed off. But I don't think, as a matter of theory, it makes any difference. Now, if I could turn just for a moment.
Anybody? Why does it, if it's so perfunctory and also 99.9%, why does it worry anybody? Why this 1983 suit?
This 1983 suit was brought, Your Honor, because nine juveniles were found not guilty.
No, and, you're not saying that in cases where the master finds no delinquency and the state takes exceptions and brings it before the judge, that 99+% of those cases the judge agrees with the master's finding of no delinquency. You're not telling us that, are you?
What I'm saying is that in 99.9% of all matters that are tried in front of the master, the judge agrees with him.
But your case, my questions earlier threw us off the track, and I apologize. Your case is a case where the juvenile is found non-delinquent by the master.
That's correct.
And the state takes an exception and takes it to the judge. And certainly you're not telling us that in 99+% of the cases the judge agrees that there's no delinquency, are you?
By no means.
Well, I didn't think so.
Absolutely.
But that's the only relevant statistic. In your case, which is your case presupposes a finding of non-delinquency by the master and exceptions by the state. That's your case.
Well, I understand that. But
and that's the only issue you raise, the issue posed by that factual situation.
That's correct. But I think that the facts in the record which indicate the relationship between the master and the judge in terms of the number of cases the master hears and what actually happens to those cases and the role that the judge plays is not wholly irrelevant in terms of basically understanding the way the system works, which is the only point I'm trying to make.
99% figure includes those in which there's no exceptions at all by either side.
Right.
That is correct.
And which is some 95% of the
99. Which is most of the cases.
That is correct. The great bulk of the cases. Now, if I could turn to the law for just a minute.
Mr. Smith, this court occasionally appoints a special master. Usually it's on a matter of great moment. And if there are no exceptions filed, would you say that our rather peremptory adoption of that is rubber stamping and that there's something wrong with it?
Well,
You seem to be saying that about the masters over in Baltimore.
From reading the opinions of this court, my impression is that the court does not, in fact, rubber stamp it. But I think it's a different question, Mr. Chief Justice, because we are dealing with proceedings that under Gault and Winship and Breed clearly come under a number of procedural protections of the Bill of Rights, and that's why I think we're here. Now, if I might for just a minute turn to the law in our case, we're making two points. The first is that there is a first jeopardy that attaches, and that it attaches at the commencement of the master's hearing. Now, I submit, and it's elaborated in our brief, that the decision of this court in Jones v. Breed explicitly so holds. It was a master in Jones v. Breed. Jeopardy attached at the start, and it is simply not true, as the state pointed out, that in California the master or the referee, as they call him there, has the power to sign an order when a child is committed. He does not have to sign. He does not have the power at all. When a child is taken out of the home, that must be affirmatively signed by the judge. Now, therefore, in our view, Jones v. Breed, or Breed v. Jones, squarely decides the first issue that the state has raised here. Remember, the state's got two arguments. The first is that jeopardy never attaches at all, and therefore there can't be a second one.
Until it gets to the judge.
Right. Now, I might say that that represents what the state said in its argument, represents a change from what it says in its brief. Its brief does not say that jeopardy attaches when the file from the master goes to the judge. Rather, it says that jeopardy can never attach until, on an exception hearing, the judge begins to hear the case de novo. Now, which either one, we suggest it's not proper. And in our view, Breed v. Jones simply decides that first question. Jeopardy does attach at the beginning of the fact finder's hearing. That is the term that has always been used. This court, in its opinion in Breed v. Jones, talked in terms of the risk of punishment. And surely when that child...
You still have not answered my point. Is there any way that the master can punish these children?
Well, Mr. Justice,
anyway,
with all respect, the question can't simply be answered like that.
But you just said it. Now, I want to test out whether you want to stick with it or not.
Well, let me stick with it.
Do you want to say that the...
If by punish you mean that child going off to a training school,
the
answer is yes.
Well, in your case, the master has acquitted them, so the question doesn't arise. That's important.
Precisely. I mean, in our case.
Right.
But your question goes to the other...
That threw us off, but let's get back to your case.
Right. Now, if I can continue for just a moment. If, as I believe I'm correct, that this court in Breed v. Jones settles the question that because there is a risk of conviction, not conviction and punishment, but a risk at the start of the master's proceeding, that jeopardy does attach, that only leaves one other question. And that question is whether a second jeopardy attaches for purposes of the double jeopardy clause when the matter goes before the judge.
Well, when a grand jury returns an indictment, a risk arises of conviction, does it not?
And yes, but not
some apprehension. Some apprehension arises on the person indicted.
That's correct, Your Honor, but that's not what we have here. I agree that that wouldn't be double jeopardy at all. It doesn't involve jeopardy. What we have here is a trial.
You have a more of a
equivalent
of where a grand jury has ignored a true bill.
Well, we
and
have
not indicted somebody.
We have I think we have more than that, Mr. Justice. We had a trial.
If there is an analogy, you have a case where a grand jury has not indicted somebody.
After hearing.
Well,
after a hearing.
All right. If you draw the analogy to the grand jury.
If Breed Jones controls this case, why do you think we grant certiorari?
It controls the first half of the case. It doesn't control the second half, which is what I'd like to spend the next couple of minutes.
Question, you've emphasized the size of Baltimore City. But I understand your argument to be an attack against the entire system. If this case had come up from Denton, for example, or Coopersville, or Frederick, you'd be making the same argument, would you?
If a master, as masters generally are not used in the outlying smaller jurisdictions, but if they were.
Other than Baltimore?
Yes, they're used in all of the major metropolitan counties except for Montgomery County, although they're being phased out this July in Prince George's, but
where they use in a county where you have one master and one judge, you'd still attack the system.
That is correct, although I might say that, you know, the parties in this case involve plaintiffs from Baltimore City and defendant state's attorney from Baltimore City. Now, the second half, and the reason what admittedly is not covered by, in terms by Jones v. Breed, is whether there is a second jeopardy that attaches when the case goes before the judge. And we think that there is for two reasons. Either because the hearing before the master, despite the fact that he has not signed his name, is sufficiently final for double jeopardy purposes when you consider that it was a trial, when you consider what double jeopardy is all about, and when you consider the realities of the system, in which case, of course, it would be a second jeopardy. Or if it's not final, surely there's only one alternative, and that is that it's not final. And if it's not final, we suggest that it nonetheless is a double jeopardy, because how does it come to be a second trial before the judge? It comes to be there because the state prevents the matter from going to its logical conclusion, which, as we all know, is going to be the stroke of a pen, and indeed was in several of these cases, the judge mistakenly signed the order early of acquittal. Instead, because the state's attorney says, no, I want another crack, that doesn't happen. And what happens instead is a new trial before the judge.
Doesn't necessarily mean a new trial. Is it not correct, the new
trial?
Well,
de novo or on the record.
But on that point, what is the normal, maybe the record briefs tell us, but I don't remember, what is the normal time interval between the master's conclusion of the proceedings before the master and the entry of the order by the judge?
At least 5 days has to go by, Mr. Justice Stevens, because that's the time that the party has to decide whether he wants to take an exception. And normally, it would be immediately thereafter if, as is virtually always the case, written findings and conclusions are waived. So normally, the answer would be it would be in five days. Now, when it goes before the judge at this second trial, whether it be on the record or de novo, in our view, that could only be justified by an exception to the normal double jeopardy rule. Now, obviously, the Ball exception is no application here, nor does the Barkas exception. So what we're talking about is the Perez-Dinitz exception. Dinitz doesn't have any application either, really. So it's the Perez exception. And our position is that this does not represent manifest necessity to prevent the trial from going to its conclusion, because that's exactly what happened. The state's attorney prevented it. Why? Because he didn't like the result. The master believed the child was not guilty, and he wants to go it again before a judge.
Well, then a necessary part of your argument, as I now understand it, Mr. Smith, is that in the lion's share of cases, after a master has recommended a finding of non-delinquency, the judge does rubber stamp it. That has to be part of your argument that you're now making.
Well, that is, it is part of our argument.
Yeah.
But the, if I could just have 30 seconds,
yes,
Mr. Chief Justice, to conclude this point. There must be some, if jeopardy did attach the first time, there's got to be some reason for concluding that there's an exception to saying that it didn't attach a second time. The continuing jeopardy doctrine, of course, has been rejected by this Court consistently right up to the present. And the only way that we can see that you can say that a second jeopardy does not attach is to claim that it's manifest necessity, and yet the very heart of this Court's manifest necessity decisions is that for the state's attorney to say, I'm not satisfied with the result, is not manifest necessity. Thank you.
Very well. Do you have anything further, Mr. Nielsen?
Very briefly, if I may use the few minutes to clarify several factual points. In the colloquy with Mr. Smith, the question came up early on in his argument about what is said and how it is said by the master at the conclusion of the case. I would agree with some of the comments which indicated that that doesn't have a, or may not have a terribly significant bearing on the legal outcome, but I think the record clearly establishes that in many cases the master specifically advises the juvenile that the state does have the opportunity to take exception, even where the master doesn't advise.
Well, if he says, I find you not guilty, he's purporting to exercise an authority that he doesn't have, doesn't he?
Well, He may be overstating it.
Well, he doesn't have the authority.
He does not have the authority, in fact, whatever he says. But I don't think that this Court should be laboring under the impression that in all cases he overstates his authority, because that is not true. The record indicates that in many instances the juveniles are specifically informed by the master that the state has the ability to take exceptions to the master's proposals. And when they're not told by the master, they're told by their own counsel, because all of the juveniles at these hearings are represented by counsel, by and large by the public defender's office. The subject of detention came up, and the question of what action the master could take with respect to detention at the time the adjudicatory hearing was over. The master at that time, as at other times, does have the authority to order interim detention of the juvenile. There is nothing special about that time. There is no special privilege or prerogative that the master has at that time to order detention as opposed to some other time.
Well, and having found him non-delinquent, the master wouldn't have occasion to do that.
Certainly, having found him non-delinquent, he is not going to order him detained, and that is this case. Mr. Smith has gone on at great length about the perfunctory nature of the court's, the judge's review of the master's recommendations. Again, as has been pointed out, this case involves cases which go up on exception. They are heard, they are argued, they are considered extensively by the judges. They are not perfunctorily reviewed. The other cases as to which no exceptions are filed, I would urge this Court, to the extent that it feels that those that how those cases are handled, to look at page 49 of the appendix, which is the stipulation of Judge Carwacki. Not, as Mr. Smith indicated, 1 minute per case, but a minimum of 15 to 20 minutes per case, sometimes hours, sometimes listening to the recording. This, again, in cases where none of the parties are taking exceptions. Not this case. Mr. Smith, also in talking with about part one of our argument on the question of when jeopardy attached, indicated that the state has changed its position from what it was in the brief, and said that in the brief we referred to the time at which the matter is heard before the master upon the taking of exception. Yes, that is the way we described it in the brief, because perhaps we were making the mistake of focusing at that point on what this case is all about, cases where exceptions are taken. There is no difference between the state's position in the brief and at argument. It is when the case gets before the judge, we say, that jeopardy attaches. When an exception is taken, that is when the exception is presented to the judge and the case is heard. In the other cases, in the lion's share of other cases, it is when the file goes before the judge with the master's recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Case is submitted.